From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the adventures of Rocky, Bullwinkle, and one of the voices behind them. We talk with Keith Scott. He's the voice of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new movie. He's also the official historian of J. Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle, Crusader Rabbit, and George of the Jungle. Scott's new book on the history of the studio is called The Moose That Roared. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new reissue Louis Armstrong, Satch Plays Fats, The Music of Fats Waller, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel Bee Season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has signed two United Nations protocols designed to protect children from being forced to fight in wars and to prevent the sexual exploitation of children. The president cited statistics showing that children are used in combat in several parts of the world.
In Sierra Leone today, as many as half the rebel forces are under 18. Some as young as 5 or 6. In Colombia, guerrillas have taken thousands of children from their villages to serve as soldiers.
The agreement also requires countries to take action against the sexual exploitation of children, including prostitution and child pornography. President Clinton says he's eager to meet with the new president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, and says Fox is welcome to come to Washington anytime. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Mexican election ended the 80-year reign of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. President Clinton acknowledged the significance of the shift in power and said he would be happy to meet with the new president to get the relationship started.
We talked a little bit about the importance of our relationship and what lies ahead, and I told him that he would be welcome here at any time if he would like to come up.
Fox has said he does plan to visit Washington, but no date has been set yet. Most of Fox's term will occur during the term of the next U.S. president, but President Clinton says that the relationship with Mexico needs to go beyond individual personalities. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Two Israeli political parties said today that they're leaving the ruling coalition because they disagree with Prime Minister Ehud Barak's decision to attend a peace summit with the Palestinians. The defections leave Barak with only 59 seats in the 120-member Israeli Knesset. In Belfast, Northern Ireland's police chief warned that Protestant hardliners are planning to launch bomb and gun attacks on his officers. His warning comes as violence flared for a fourth night in a row. Marianne McGuire reports from Drumcree.
Sir Ronnie Flanagan said he had heard disturbing reports of the intent of what he called some evil people on the extreme fringe. He issued the warning as violence flared for the fourth consecutive night. In Belfast, supporters of the Orange Order closed roads in hardline Protestant estates. They are intent on stepping up protests against the decision to ban an orange parade in the Catholic neighbourhood of Portadown on Sunday. Rush hour traffic was badly affected. In Portadown, a crowd of several hundred demonstrators gathered at Drumcree Church after two parades. The British Army and police have increased their presence in the area. A military-style barricade has been erected on the bridge leading to the Catholic neighbourhood. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Drumcree.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 77 points to close at 10,483 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq lost 128 points. This is NPR News. Officials in Jordan say security guards managed to stop an attempted hijacking aboard a Royal Jordanian passenger jet today, but only after a hijacker threw a bomb that injured 15 passengers. Officials say the guards killed the hijacker as he tried to enter the plane's cockpit. The plane, which had been airborne on a flight from Amman to Damascus, managed to return and land safely in Amman. New Jersey colleges, universities, and boarding schools have been ordered to retrofit all dormitories with fire suppression sprinklers. The move comes in response to a deadly fire at Seton Hall University. Eugene Son reports from member station WBGO in Newark.
New Jersey Governor Christy Whitman came to Seton Hall in South Orange to sign a bill demanding that all dorms, not just new ones, be fitted with fire sprinklers. Whitman says the new law is a small tribute to the three students who died in a January fire at Seton Hall.
Over the next 4 years, every dorm, every bed, every student will be protected by a sprinkler system.
Though the investigation into the fatal fire is continuing, experts say the blaze could have been put out or at least contained if the dorm had had sprinklers. The state will loan the schools the money for the massive undertaking. It's unclear whether there will be enough sprinkler installation crews available to put the devices in every dorm by the 2004 deadline. For NPR News, I'm Eugene Son.
Some members of the OPEC oil cartel are uniting in opposition to Saudi Arabia's plan to produce more oil in an effort to drive down world oil prices. Iran, Iraq, Libya, and other members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries are urging Saudi Arabia not to act without consulting them. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, let's go!
Not so fast, Brock. We're the heroes, remember?
So?
So the heroes always arrive in the today nick of time.
During the Cold War era, Rocky and Bullwinkle repeatedly managed to foil the plans of the two evil spies, Boris Badenov and Natasha Fatale. The cartoon series premiered in 1959. Now Rocky, his friends, and enemies are back in the new movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. The voice of Rocky is done by June Foray, who originated the voice. My guest, Keith Scott, does the voices for Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film. Scott is also the historian for J. Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle. His new book about the studio is called The Moose That Roared. Let's hear a scene from the new film. Boris and Natasha have crossed over from their cartoon lives into the real world. Rocky and Bullwinkle manage to follow, but the talking squirrel and dim-witted moose have trouble fitting into the real world.
So on they walked, two lone figures making their way through a foreign and hostile live-action landscape.
Thought you said we were in Oklahoma.
Would you like to narrate this movie?
No.
And so on they walked.
Keith Scott, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Derry.
Who was the originator of Bullwinkle's voice?
The originator was Bill Scott. And, you know, it's kind of funny because there's this movie database.com that keeps insisting I'm his son. And we're not related. And yet I knew him very well. And, you know, because I was always the world's biggest fan of this this property. And he could tell that. He could tell I wasn't just an autograph seeker. So he began a correspondence with me, and he always used to kind of jokingly sign, you know, perhaps I'm your long-lost uncle, Bill Scott.
Did he talk with you about creating the voice?
Yes, he did. He said that originally Bullwinkle was always conceived as kind of, you know, I guess a generic dumb cartoon voice where in old cartoons you always heard the, which way did he go, George? Gee, Rocky. You know, so it was always these dumb sort of characters, as they used to call them. And so he made him what he described as a smart goof. In other words, there was a lot more going on in Bullwinkle's head, even though he had this kind of dumb voice.
Right. Now, what do you do to get that voice? Where do you place your voice in your head?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to physically describe where my throat is doing that, but I think it's because for, I guess, 40 years of my 46 years, I've been the world's biggest fan of this, so it's just osmosis. Listening, and also Bill Scott gave me all the original recording session tapes, so you kind of became like a fly on the wall. You could hear the actors developing these voices or get inside the actors' heads rather than just the character.
So really, I can't describe how I do this. There's a lot of air there and a lot of diaphragm and also a lot of charisma, I think.
You've also done the voice of the announcer, and you do the announcer's voice for the new Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. Who was the original announcer?
Well, that was William Conrad, who was, some of your listeners may remember the TV series Cannon, and he was kind of a fairly rotund guy, but of course, you know, all of these great voice actors that they used were originally in the days of network radio drama and comedy. So William Conrad was really well known as the voice of Matt Dillon in the original Gunsmoke.
And he had this very deep, rolling sort of voice. And I'm that man,
Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
But of course, when he did the show, the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, he was a lot more cartoony, so it was...
In our last episode, those intrepid heroes, Rocky and Bullwinkle, were being followed by that vicious villain, Boris Badenoff.
That's great. I think it's really funny that you should be both doing the voice of the goofy Bullwinkle and the authoritative announcer.
It's so weird because in this new movie, there's even a line where Bullwinkle's walking through this angry crowd at the university, Wasamariyu, which they recreated from the old cartoons. And the narrator says,
and our insipid hero made it through the crowd.
And then Bullwinkle says, don't you mean intrepid hero? And there's a little pause and he goes, no.
And did you do those voices back to back, having a conversation with yourself, or did you record them separately?
Pretty much back to back on the read-throughs and the pre-record, but as you know, on a big budget picture like this, eventually everything gets replaced. And I think for consistency of character, it's better if you read just one character's lines. In fact, even in the old Warner Brothers cartoons, Mel Blanc always used to admit that he'd do all of Bugs Bunny's lines first and then come back and do Yosemite Sam, or he wouldn't have a voice box left.
Right. Now, you don't do the voice of the Russian spy, Boris Badenoff, in the movie, but you have done Boris Badenoff for other versions of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Well, you know, I do Boris's voice in the movie. There's a short section where you see the characters in normal cell animation, and I'd forgotten that because I hadn't seen the whole picture until the premiere last Saturday on the 24th of June. And it was amazing because there's a little tiny section where Boris and Fearless Leader and Natasha enter the real world, and June and I did those voices. I did Fearless Leader and Boris. And then, of course, they become Jason Alexander and Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm. You want to give us a little taste of Boris?
Was Boris Badenoff, incompetent little Botsylvanian spy. Oh, boy, Natasha.
What a great laugh. Now, who is that voice based on?
Well, Paul Frees, the originator of the voice of Boris Badenoff and many, many other voices on the old cartoons, actually admitted that he took Boris's voice from a veteran character actor named Akim Tamarov, who, you know, I guess you could see him in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and a lot of old films from the 40s, like For Whom the Bell Tolls. And he was always these little, very charismatic villains, often with that Balkan dialect. So he took a bit of that and then a little bit of this character that a Jewish comic called Bert Gordon did on the Eddie Cantor show. It was one of those weekly characters that used to appear on old-time radio. The audience would look forward to it. It was called the Mad Russian. And it was always, how do you do? So I think he just kind of combined those two voices, and we had this crazy villain.
My guest is voice artist Keith Scott, author of the new book, The Moose That Roared.
Boris, why you're coughing?
I'm used to breathing good old city smog, Natasha. This fresh air is killing me.
More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Keith Scott. He does the voices for Bullwinkle and the announcer in the new movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. One more voice I want you to do, which is also a voice from Jay Ward cartoons, and that's Dudley Do-Right.
Right. Yes, Dudley Do-Right of the Mounties. The
only Mountie ever to arrest a redwood tree for loitering.
Now, is Dudley Do-Right based on the singer and actor Nelson Eddy in his voice?
Yeah, I think originally Bill Scott did a kind of I mean, in one of the old Dudley Do-Right cartoons, they had him deliberately doing that tribute to Nelson Eddy from Rosemarie, where he played the red-coated Mountie.
The singing
but
Mountie?
Well, yeah, it was operatic. That was a Victor Herbert opera, Rosemarie. But when Nelson Eddy had a radio show in Hollywood in the 40s, for some peculiar reason, his theme song was "A Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening, Shortening." And in one of the Dudley Do-Rights, Nell falls over in a fainting spell. So Dudley says, "I'll revive her with my glorious voice. A Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening, Shortening. Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread." And then she comes to life again. So.
Now let's get back to Rocky and Bullwinkle. What do you love about the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons?
I've loved them and been a booster of them for so many years. I still think it boils down to the writing. They really were so like light years ahead of their time. I mean, I think the younger audiences coming up today who've been weaned on, you know, all the channels from the days in the crib are far more media literate than audiences 35, 40 years ago. But I think if Rocky and Bullwinkle began today with those that same sort of very hip and self-reflexive writing style, it would be as big as The Simpsons, I'm sure. As you know, Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, always used to say that he was influenced by Bullwinkle.
For anyone who's never seen Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, what's the basic premise?
Well, the premise is that these two zany-looking heroes, you know, the design is just so cheap and funny. This very tall moose and this very short squirrel are best buddies. They live in Frostbite Falls, Minnesota. And in every adventure, they travel the world and foil the plans of this Cold War villain couple, Boris Badenoff and Natasha Fatale. And they do it just by lucking out, mainly. So the whole thing is a takeoff on melodrama and, you know, white-hatted heroes. But it's just done in a very light-hearted, charming, satirical style. But the main thing to say about these cartoons is that they all eventuated when there was so much competition of bland cartoons, you know, cats chasing mice and that sort of thing. So that these stood out for anyone who Bill Scott used to call the smart kids, suddenly picked these out as something special because at the same time that, you know, Yogi Bear was stealing a pie off the windowsill, Rocky and Bullwinkle were satirizing politics and TV executives and things that really were way over the kids' heads, so that Bill Scott and Jay Ward used to say you could keep coming back to these cartoons from young childhood through early high school and then into adulthood on three different levels. Then you'd keep getting things that you didn't get the previous time.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons? And in this one, the spies Boris and Natasha have drained Lake Salle de Bain, which, of course, in French means bathroom.
and
they've drained the lake. They've basically pulled a plug to drain the lake in order to get at a trunk of treasure buried at the bottom. And after they
The treasure chest of Montezum.
Yes, I kept expecting Montezuma's revenge to be the end of this. But after they get the chest with the treasure in it, they can't open the chest. So they throw it off a little mountain, hoping that when it hits the ground, it will open. But what happens is Boris Badenov ends up falling off the little mountain with the chest, and the chest lands on top of him. As he's falling, Natasha yells some advice to him.
Don't worry, darling. Remember, this is just cartoon. Boris, are you all right?
Natasha, I just found out what happens when a cartoon chest falls on a cartoon character.
What?
It hurts!
And what's more, darling?
What could be what's more?
The chest still isn't open.
Fui and double fui.
That voice, Bullwinkle! Where have I heard that voice?
I heard something like it once when I dropped a chicken bone in the garbage disposal.
That does it, Natasha. Come on, we're going to get an A-bomb.
A-bomb?
A-bomb, come on.
Did you hear that, Bullwinkle?
Sure, they repeated it twice.
Do you know what A-bomb means?
Certainly. A-bomb is what some people call our program.
I don't think that's so funny.
Neither do they, apparently.
Do you know why Jay Ward decided to have these two Russian spies and make it a Cold War comedy?
I believe that was Bill Scott's decision. He wrote the script for the pilot film, and I think he wrote it in around about Christmas of 1957, and that, of course, was Sputnik era, and it was when the tensions of the Cold War were, you know, at their height. So it was, I think it was just topical, and he was a very topical person. He was, if he hadn't been in animation, I'm sure he would have been one of these comedians like Stan Freberg, you know, who was doing whatever was in the news at the time. Not mother-in-law jokes, but I'm talking like political jokes, you know. So I think then when they created the characters, they based the look of it kind of as a tribute to Charles Adams, the cartoonist, you know, with the Adams family. Gomez and Morticia, as they were named in the TV show, they never had a name in the old panel cartoons, looked very much like Boris and Natasha. And I think once that story developed and then the show was picked up and renewed, they decided to keep those villains because the Cold War had continued, and they were just, they had ended up in the first 40 episodes as very funny, bumbling characters that looked viable for a long life.
Do you know anything about Jay Ward's and Bill Scott's politics?
The only thing I knew is that, as you know, as I mentioned, Bill Scott's son said that my dad was a screaming lefty, and he was. I mean, he was involved in many causes. He did commercials for Mental Health Foundation. He was a member of the Civil Liberties Union, and Jay Ward, strangely enough, was a staunch Republican. And yet these two got on and giggled all day long, and they were totally politically opposed.
Many of the jokes in Rocky and Bullwinkle had to go over the heads of kids who were watching. Did Jay Ward care whether kids got the jokes or not?
I don't think he really cared, because he was clever enough to realize that they could see it, especially very small kids could watch the cartoons and be enchanted by the odd-looking design. And just the storyline itself, there was a sense of adventure that even the youngest audiences got. But he always spoke very intelligently about his audiences. Whenever he got dictation from the networks or the sponsor saying, you know, too many adult references, too much showbiz material, you know, you're going to offend some Greek national if you do that dialect, you know, or complaint after complaint. And he would always say, you know, the kids are going to get this. You know, audiences have brains. So both of them presumed a degree of intelligence in the viewers, which network people were renowned for doing the complete opposite, you know.
Who were the sponsors of Rocky and Bullwinkle on TV?
General Mills, the big breakfast cereal concern and flour mill. They were the sponsors, and they still, because of a kind of a deal that had to be made when Jay Ward was very ill to get the show sold. One of the unfortunate things for Ward Productions is that there's one clause in there which says that for the continental United States, all the TV rights remain with General Mills into perpetuity.
How did the sponsor have so much control that the sponsors were able to complain about the content of the program?
Because I think in those days, which was only, you know, television had only been a reality for a decade. So there was a lot of practices that had come from, you know, four decades of network radio. And in those days, the sponsor, this kind of died out in the late 60s, early 70s, but the sponsors used to own the shows. In fact, General Mills also owned The Lone Ranger. And so, really, if you had a TV show, the sponsor kind of controlled it through their advertising agency.
Well, you say that since the sponsor for Rocky and Bullwinkle had also sponsored the Lone Ranger, Rocky and Bullwinkle weren't allowed to make fun of the Lone Ranger or even his horse, Silver.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what they were told. I think they went ahead and did. I know that there was, you know, there were references to who was that masked man, that famous line from The Lone Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like they were taunting the sponsor. And to be honest, the sponsors weren't the villains of the story. I think the ones who were really a lot more finicky were the advertising agency, because they lived in fear of the sponsor dropping their account. or the ABC TV network, as I point out, you know, in the book, especially NBC in those days. The three networks were far more conservative than they are these days.
Can you remember something that the network objected to?
They definitely objected to some of the voices in the early days, especially if there was, I think in one of the Hoppity Hooper cartoons, that was a lesser series that he did after Bullwinkle, Paul Frees imitated Senator Everett Dirksen, who had that kind of a voice. And they got these fear-filled letters saying, oh, we can't do that voice. And of course, Jay Ward would always play dumb. He said, well, you just made that funny voice up on the spot. And of course, it was a politician.
Well, you quote Jay Ward as having once said, if we paid attention to the list of do's and don'ts supplied by the network, the sponsor, and the agency, all we could say would be hello and goodbye, and we'd even have to shorten that a little.
That was his colorful publicity, but I guess that was in a kind of a way it was truthful, because they would get memo after memo. I mean, Bill Scott gave me a lot of the correspondences for my research in this book before he passed away, and there was daily complaints, but I think a lot of that was in the first season. Then, of course, Rocky and His Friends, which was the original title, went on to surprisingly become the highest-rated daytime show, and these directives got less and less.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of formed that sort of relationship that a lot of creative versus suit things form. You know, finally they learn to live with each other's eccentricities.
Keith Scott does the voices of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And he's the author of the new book, The Moose That Roared. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
And now for the cultural part of our program, we bring you Bullwinkle's Corner with that moose of letters, Bullwinkle.
Hello there. Today's poem is from Mother Moose.
Mother Goose.
Goose? Must be a misprint. Anyways, the poem is Little Miss Muffet. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet.
What's a tuffet?
Hmm?
What's a tuffet?
It's what I'm sitting on, eating her curds and whey. Boy, this stuff is terrible. Along come a spider at... You were the spider?
He couldn't make it.
But you ain't scary. You're supposed to scare me.
Okay, fellas, up.
Take two. Along come a spider and sat down beside her and... a spider, a spider!
Hey!
Hello, Rock.
Hey, Miss Muffet, your curds and whey are on your head.
Let me tell you something. I'd rather wear them than eat them.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah Maugah, a novel about love and painting in 17th century Amsterdam. And from Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to music from Satch Plays Fats. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews this new Louis Armstrong reissue. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel Bee Season, and we continue our conversation with Keith Scott, the voice of Bullwinkle in the new movie. We'll be right back.
look like something's bothering you.
There's nothing bothering me, honey, that a piece of roast beef can't fix up.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Pops. A man works hard, then comes on home.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Now, it's time to get back to our story.
My guest, Keith Scott, does the voices of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. He's also the official historian of Jay Ward Productions, the animation studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle, Crusader Rabbit, and George of the Jungle. Scott has written a new book about the studio called The Moose That Roared. Now Keith Scott, you grew up in Australia, and our listeners could probably hear the remains of your Australian accent. You grew up in Sydney. When did Rocky and Bullwinkle come to Sydney television?
It was in 1960. Australia was the first foreign sale that they had. I don't know if it ever really went to England in a big way. I don't think it did. It was certainly very big in Australia and New Zealand. But, 1960, when I was 7 years of age.
So TV was very new in your house when you started watching Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, I think we'd only had a set for like a year. Of course, I'd already seen Crusader Rabbit and Huckleberry Hound and Tom Terrific and all of the competition. And again, you know, realized from a very early age that I was one of these, you know, people who loved comic books and cartoon art, Disney caricatures, Mad Magazine, that type of pop culture.
Now, go ahead.
Kind of embarrassing to say, I still haven't grown up 40 years later.
How did you, as a kid growing up in Sydney, get to meet the people behind Rocky and Bullwinkle?
I think it was just that my interest in the humor and the voices in the show had gone on. And, of course, once that interest remains, you start asking more and more questions that roll around in your head, like, what do these people look like, or who are they, or what are their backgrounds, or how did they come up with these voices, or who wrote the scripts? And it just kept building and building in me until finally I, on a whim, I wrote to a local TV station, and they gave me an address where they thought maybe my correspondence would get to. Well, the first one I wrote to was Doss Butler, who was probably more famous for his Hanna-Barbera characters, like Huckleberry Hound and, you know, Mr. Jinx from Pixie and Dixie.
Mr. Jinx, who clobbered the miserable nieces to pieces, like.
And those characters. But he was like 5 feet 2 inches tall, and he was like a little Irish pixie, and known for being one of the warmest people in Hollywood. Well, you know, I never expected to get an answer from these people because they seemed so daunting to someone so young. But he couldn't have been nicer. He sent a very detailed letter. He gave me Bill Scott's address to write to, his home address, June Foray's address. So it really started as a kind of super fan meets his idols and eventually got into the same line of work as them while they were still alive to see that happen. So it really, you know, it's very strange the way fate takes you sometimes.
You started off doing voices for cartoons and commercials in Australia. Mm-hmm. What kinds of characters on the cartoons and commercials?
Very similar to what the Jay Ward actors did, because when you're doing cartoons, sometimes they'll show you a model sheet of a character, and they say, well, it's kind of like, you know, and then generally when they say that, it means it's either an impersonation of a famous, you know, actor, or an exaggeration of that person. So there's a local cartoon series that we make in Sydney for based on a German property. Of course, it's redubbed when it goes back to Europe, but I do the two villainous characters in that, and I based
one of them on this very sort of temperamental character that there's a radio actor here in Hollywood called Joseph Kearns, used to play Mr. Wilson on Dennis the Menace, you see.
And then his offsider was called James, and they were just kidding around when we saw this little penguin, this very obsequious little penguin, and for some reason they called him James, so everyone just looked at each other and said, James Mason.
So I've got this little penguin who talks like James Mason. Yes, master, whatever you say.
Do you have to do anything to protect your voice and to protect your throat?
Not really. No, I never have. I've got... I guess I'm blessed with a strong constitution because I do all the things I shouldn't. I drink too much coffee. I still smoke an occasional cigarette. I really think a lot of these people who use their voice a lot, your voice just gets much stronger with use, you know, and probably abuse. I've never had a sore throat in 40 years of doing this.
Wow.
And yet the strange thing is, I've never had nodules or anything like that, but I'm sure if a voice teacher heard me doing, you know, like Yosemite Sam, or anything like that, they'd be quaking, saying, don't do that to your throat.
It's funny because one of the things you have to do while you're doing all these voices is drop your Australian accent. Like, you can't do Bullwinkle with an Australian accent. Or maybe you could. That would be interesting.
Well, I don't know about that, mate.
Right. So you had to learn to speak American, among other things.
Yes, I think it's because of my interest in animation history and so on. I've kind of had the American dialects in my head for so many decades that it's very easy for me to hear with a pair of headphones on if I'm doing the accent correctly, you know. And also with British voices. I mean, I can put on a very broad Australian, you know, like Paul Hogan, you know, one of those Australians.
Right.
And then I think it's just through constant listening to tapes of famous people that I could go from, you know, doing Paul Hogan to a very well-known English voice like Alec Guinness. I want you to build that bridge and officers will do the work of enlisted men. And then go to some American voice.
Like Bullwinkle Boos.
Or even an amalgam, you know, like an American star, but with one of those odd accents like... Schwarzenegger, who's like, I am a cybernetic organism, living tissue over metallic parts. or Stallone, which is kind of almost a cartoon voice in himself.
I need no manager, you know.
That's true. It is really almost a cartoon voice in itself.
It is. It's very, you know, because that scene in Rocky with Burgess Meredith where he said, come on, kid, listen, I got pain, I got experience.
Oh, I got pain, I got experience too, you know.
My guest is Keith Scott. He does the voices for Bullwinkle and the announcer in the new movie, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Keith Scott, and he does the voices for Bullwinkle and the narrator and a little bit of Boris Badenov in the new Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. And he's also written a book about the history of Rocky and Bullwinkle and the other cartoons that were created by Jay Ward Productions. The book is called The Moose That Roared. I grew up on cartoons. You grew up on cartoons. I know some of my dreams were affected by cartoons. I used to have this recurring dream where I'd be like driving in a convertible and I'd kind of crash into something and I'd go kind of like flying up into the sky and then slowly fly down, as only happens in cartoons. But I'm wondering if any of your sense of if any of your dreams or things like that were influenced at all by cartoon physics.
That could well be, because I'm always thinking in terms of gags. You know, when they were doing the old Laurel and Hardy shorts here in Hollywood or Culver City, Stan Laurel had that kind of a mind. If he was driving along and had to brake quickly, his mind would immediately snap to what would happen in a gag, even though he almost just got killed, you know. I tend to be like that. It's this constant exposure to the comedy and the dynamics of cartoons and the rhythm of comedy. So I don't know if that's a good thing or bad.
Do you have any strong feelings about parents and TV executives who actually worry about cartoon violence?
Yeah, I think that's a little exaggerated because they always seem to quote the Roadrunner. And the violence only happens to the coyote in that, where and it's self-inflicted. His traps don't work, or he keeps falling off a cliff and ending up looking like an accordion when he walks, and then suddenly he's back to normal again. I think, to me, the more disturbing cartoons are the realistically drawn superhero ones with all of those that constant barrage of noise of machine gun fire, and which I guess has now gone into the a lot of the computer games, you know, these awful kill your opponent, all that thing. I think the gag cartoons like Bugs Bunny and all that, I'm convinced that all the kids I knew when I was very young knew that it was just a cartoon, in inverted commas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was a gag. Another problem, too, is the fact that because everything is now constantly repeated on video and television, and there's two or three generations now who don't even realize that 90% of those old theatrical cartoons were made for theaters, for an adult audience, to be seen maybe twice and then put on a shelf forever. And then when this new recording technology with videotape came along, nobody in those days even knew that these things would have a life for 60 years.
You know, I'm thinking in one of the early Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, Rocky and Bullwinkle make a joke about how the network executives don't like violent cartoons. And this, yes. this was back in the 50s or early 60s, this cartoon.
Yeah, I think that what happened was that they had drawn them in one episode as if they were going to fall into a cannibal pot on this island of Rikki-Tikki. And they got some dictation from the network saying, well, we won't allow cannibalism with our characters. And Jay Ward actually sent a serious letter saying, cannibalism? To eat a moose and squirrel? and that was publicized in Newsweek. And then about the second storyline after that, there was a scene where Rocky and Bullwinkle are captured by a gigantic Native American and tied to a stake and just about to be set fire to. And Rocky whips out a contract and says, the network says, no cannibalism on TV. So he was always biting the hand that fed him. He was kind of a maverick. I'm sure he was one of those people in those days, they used to mutter and shake their heads and say, I don't know, you know, can we end this contract as soon as possible? This guy's too much trouble.
Keith Scott, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. And I've just got a couple of friends here who just want to say goodbye.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry. Bullwinkle J. Moose here, and doing your show has been kind of a breath of fresh air. You get it? I said...
Oh, go away, Moose. That was stupid.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
That's great. Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you a lot, Terry.
Keith Scott is the voice of Bullwinkle and the narrator in the new film The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, and he's the author of the new book, The Moose That Roared. That's music from the newly reissued recording Satch Plays Fats, the music of Fats Waller. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, in the 1950s, a lot of jazz fans disliked Louis Armstrong's band, the All-Stars, and hated their female singer, Velma Middleton. The band usually played a small repertoire and highlighted Armstrong the entertainer more than the jazz virtuoso. Even so, in the mid-50s, Armstrong and Company made two LPs even skeptics approved of. One of those was Satch Plays Fats. Kevin has a review.
I'm walking on air, for I've left all my blue days behind. And I learned how to care, and there's love, really love, on my mind. Yes, I'm the world's most happiest creature. Tell me, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby, and my baby's crazy about me. Mr. Cupid was our teacher.
Hard to imagine a better marriage of artist and subject than Louis Armstrong and Fats Waller. Both were early jazz modernists with vision and superb instrumental technique. Fats was one of the best of the 1920s stride piano players. Both also had a keen sense of humor, including an ability to laugh at themselves. They'd been friends since the mid-20s, even before they'd played together a few times in Chicago. In 1929, Armstrong's success singing Waller's Ain't Misbehavin' in the Broadway show Hot Chocolates helped launch the trumpeter as a popular entertainer. That may also have encouraged Waller to start singing on record. And by spooky coincidence, when Fats died of pneumonia on a train stopped at Kansas City Station in 1943, Armstrong was sitting on another train held up nearby. Recorded in 1955, Satch Plays Fats was Armstrong's follow-up to a fine album of W.C. Handy compositions. It was one of those rare sequels that measured up to the original, his Godfather Part II. Half a century later, it's puzzling that contemporary jazz hounds so resented his all-stars, who were really all right. This version included ex-Ellington clarinetist Barney Bigard, Billy Kyle on piano, and Barrett Deems on drums. By the 1950s, Armstrong sang more and played less than most fans wished, and his solos kept close to the melody. But the ways he'd subtly alter its timing and phrasing define what swing is. That's I've Got a Feeling I'm Falling. As good as Armstrong's playing is here, it's still odd anyone complain they got so much of Armstrong, the most influential singer of his century, most influential for pioneering wordless scat singing and for popularizing a rough vocal texture. Since we CD listeners don't have to watch singer Velma Middleton doing splits on stage, a blood-curdling sight by many reports, we can also judge her talents more objectively. She's not one of the greats, but her more plain style could really set up the boss. Middleton knew how to egg him on.
Say, I have no use for other sweets of any kind, baby, since the day you came around. From the start, I instantly made up my mind that you're the sweetest sweet that can be found.
You so sweet.
Oh, Pops.
Can't be beat.
You mean it?
Nothing sweeter ever stood on feet. Yes, everyone to be filled with jealousy when they see you out with me. I don't blame them, goodness knows. Honeysuckle rose, but
say, when you passing by, flowers droop inside.
Composer Fats Waller was such an entertaining singer himself, folks may overlook how carefully crafted his songs are. His chord progressions were so ingenious, generations of jazz musicians have borrowed them for their own tunes. His melodies are equally clever, one reason to be glad Armstrong doesn't mess with them much. It's good that Satch Plays Fats is back out, as Columbia had botched a previous CD of this material by substituting alternate takes for most of the original masters. The new CD restores the old LP program and adds four unreleased alternates, plus seven Armstrong versions of Waller tunes from the late 20s and early 30s. That makes almost 80 minutes of music, as much as a CD will hold. This time, they got it right.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Satch Plays Fats, a reissue on the Columbia Legacy label.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, I'm happy on a show, babe. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love. Oh, baby, love you, really, baby, love you. I know it's saying, one I love, through it flooding. You that I'm thinking of, ain't misbehaving, saving my love. Oh, baby, my love for you. Jackie Horner, you're in the corner, don't go nowhere, and I don't care, all your kisses weren't waiting for me. Daddy, 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 I don't stay out late, don't care to go, I'm home about me and my radio, babe, ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Bee Season. This is Fresh Air. Season, a first novel by Myla Goldberg, has generated a lot of buzz in literary circles. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's well-deserved.
I couldn't sleep a few nights ago, so I picked up Myla Goldberg's first novel, Bee Season, and read it almost in one wired sitting in the dead of night. That was probably the ideal situation for reading this bleak, curious story. Madness of all shapes, secular and divine, domesticated and dangerous, is Goldberg's subject, and she handles it with the jaded assurance of a young writer who probably grew up watching Twin Peaks reruns and then went on to college to double major in aberration and disillusionment. Which is not to say that I don't think Goldberg is an extraordinary first-time novelist. I do. I'm just a little afraid of her and her vivid, merciless imagination. The bees in Bee Season are the spelling, not the stinging kind. The novel opens with a description of fifth grader Eliza Nauman, who's about to take part in her class's spelling bee. Even if the rest of this novel weren't so compelling, it would be worth reading for Goldberg's wry, malicious rendering of the misguided, feel-good pedagogical styles that have set the tone in recent decades in middle-class American elementary schools. Eliza, Goldberg informs us, has been designated as a student from whom great things should not be expected. She's been shunted away from the gifted and talented programs that proliferate in her school. Instead, her classroom is decorated with posters of kittens and puppies trying to climb ladders above captions that read, "Hang in there." After Eliza stuns everybody by winning her school-wide spelling bee, she goes on to the district contest, where a beaming adult welcomes the young contestants by assuring them that this is not a competition, it's a celebration. No wonder Generation Y is so cynical. Eliza eventually goes on to compete, or celebrate, in the National Bee in Washington. At every stage of the process, Goldberg excruciatingly describes the thick, sadistic atmosphere of suspense that hangs over these contests. Here's a snippet of a passage describing the torment of Eliza's fellow contestants. The hardest to watch are those who know they have made a mistake. Sometimes they stop mid-word, the air knocked out of them. Even then, they are expected to continue until the word is finished. They flinch their way to the word's end, mere shadows of the child they were before the mistake was made. Finally, the misspelled word is complete, its mistaken A or extra T dangling like a flap of dead skin. Eliza loses the National Bee, but her newly discovered spelling prowess sets off a series of changes in her family, none of them good. Her father, Saul, a cantor and a lifelong student of Jewish mysticism, decides that Eliza possesses the ability to commune with the divine through her almost magical skill with words. He begins tutoring her in esoteric texts, shoving aside his former star pupil, Eliza's teenaged brother, Aaron. Rebuffed, Aaron finds solace in a local Hare Krishna temple. And Eliza's mother, Miriam, who has also had more time on her hands now that Saul is cloistered in his study with Eliza, lets herself succumb more and more to the bizarre compulsions that have secretly given her life meaning for years. Miriam is the only weak element in this novel. Her craziness is so far advanced, it needs more explaining to be plausible. But otherwise, Goldberg, like her character Eliza, proves herself to be a whiz at parsing out things. In Goldberg's case, not words, but intangible emotional states. One stumble and Bee Season could have turned into a farce, or even worse, a suburban melodrama. But sure-footed Goldberg doesn't stumble. In the ambiguous climax of the novel, Eliza either surrenders to the family strain of madness or makes an act of self-sacrifice on a par with that of Dickens' Sidney Carton in A Tale of Two Cities. If you lean toward the latter reading, then it is a far, far better thing that she does than she had ever done. And like Carton, Eliza loses her head but regains her soul.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Bee Season by Myla Goldberg. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross, and I'd like to welcome the listeners of Public Radio East in Eastern Carolina, which has just started broadcasting Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Younger Than That Now, A Shared Passage from the 60s by Jeff Dershowitz and Ruth Williams, a memoir. And from Random House Inc. and its Vintage Books Division, paperback publishers of The First World War by John Keegan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, understanding cancer and its genetic mutations from a Darwinian perspective. We talk to Dr. Mel Greaves about his new book, Cancer, the Evolutionary Legacy. Greaves directs the Leukemia Research Center at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.